The Industrial Revolution played out over a couple of hundred years. We're going to have a scale of change that's comparable but compressed over a couple of decades. Two rooms, one with a computer and one with a human, and you ask them each questions, maybe like with a teletype, you know, printed. If you couldn't tell which was which, then the machine was considered intelligent. That became known as the Turing test. I think it was a very cool test, and when I was a kid, I thought it was like a great test. Now I think it's about as good a test of intelligence as if you saw a magician levitating a woman would be a test of whether you'd solved gravity. And that's just a lot harder to adjust to. Now, the wrong thing to do, the one thing I know we shouldn't do, is try to freeze all the jobs just the way they are. I really am looking forward to what John Maynard Keynes called the end of the economic problem, that we can finally, first time in history, address, you know, scarcity of food, clothing, shelter. I think we are very close to getting that, and I could see that happening soon.
Something that personally is a lot on my mind is what are the right jobs to be in during this AI transformation. So yeah. Both of my daughters, they soon will enter high school, and I'm really at loss. What should I advise them? Yeah. Like, what career to pursue them? So what would be your advice here?
Hey, I'm Alexander, and welcome to Before AGI. One of the most important impacts of AI will be that on the labor market, how it affects our jobs, productivity, and livelihoods. The impact of technology on labor is, of course, an age-old question. However, in the context of AI, many unique issues, as well as possible features, be it positive or negative, arise. This is why I'm fortunate to be able to talk with Eric Brynjolfsson about this today. Eric is a professor at Stanford. He directs the Digital Economy Lab, and before that, he was at MIT. Over the years, he has done pioneering research starting the questions around the economic impacts of information technologies, and in fact, he was doing this way before AI became popular. Today, we discuss the different paths in our future. Whether AI will augment humans or replace us, increase inequality or level the playing field, empower our personal productivity or stagnate our growth. Eric has thought deeply about these issues, has lots of interesting takes, and really believes we can make the brighter future happen. So let's see how it's possible.
Eric, it's a pleasure to have you.
Delighted to be here.
So, look, if you think about the labor and AI, there's a lot of uncertainty about this, a lot of excitement, a lot of many, many feelings. And you are, I think you call yourself a mindful optimist here.
That's right.
So hit me with the positive case.
The positive case. Well, you know, AI has always been destroying jobs. It's always been creating jobs. And that's just been the way it's been since technology was invented. This is a period of faster change, but I'm hopeful that this could be the best 10 years we've ever had. Ultimately, productivity is what drives our living standards. It's what makes us healthier, wealthier, better off. And the key to productivity is technology. Better technology leads to higher productivity. That's more output per worker, and that leads to better lives.
Okay, let's make it a bit more concrete. So imagine it's 2035. I'm an office worker, like a typical office worker. How could my life look like?
Well, 2035 is actually pretty far off, I'm discovering. When I wrote The Second Machine Age with Andy McAfee in 2014, you know, I thought that AGI, or AI that could do most of the tasks that humans could do, was 50, 60, or 100 years away. Now, the past few years, talking to the folks at OpenAI and Anthropic and Google and everywhere else, I'm hearing people who are very optimistic about technology that can do most tasks that humans can do by 2035, within 10 years. I don't know if that's right or not. I'm not the technologist, so I'm kind of curating these different things. But it's possible that by 2035, AI could do a large percentage of the cognitive tasks that people are doing today. So that would be a really very different world. It would be a world where we'd have to start thinking about how we distribute wealth and income in ways other than just depending on labor. And I'm not sure we're going to hit those milestones in those 10 years, but I think it's on the planning horizon.
I see. So yeah, by the way, I could talk about my timelines, and they definitely shorten since I joined OpenAI.
Yeah.
Although, as I like to say, is just by joining OpenAI, I can see into the future, but maybe half or a year into it. So good luck 10 years into that. But just before we kind of arrive to this future where like there is no work, or at least not cognitive work, that needs to be done.
Right.
Like, so maybe in the, let's say, 5 years from now, how do you see AI blending into our kind of office work, for instance?
Well, 5 years is much more realistic because we're already beginning to see glimmers of it. Many of the technologies that are going to be widely used in 5 years already exist. I mean, one of the first things I realized as an economist, and has become more and more clear over the past, you know, 30 years that I've been working this field, is that it's one thing to invent a technology. It's another thing for it to be widely adopted. Often it takes 5, 10, even 20 or 30 years before technology is diffused. So right now we do see technologies that are helping people write memos. We see technologies that are helping with diagnosing diseases. We see technologies that are helping with customer service and coding. And they're not yet widely diffused. There's just a few leading edge companies. So in 5 years, I expect it to be much more widely diffused, and we're going to have a distribution. In the research that I've been looking at, we find that the technology has been leading to bigger and bigger gaps between companies. The leaders are pulling away. The top 10%, the top 20% of firms are pulling away, whether you measure it by profits, sales, return on investment. They're adopting these technologies and getting a lot of benefits from it. And the median firm or the lagging firms are falling further behind. So we see a bigger gap between the top firms and the rest of the firms. And we will probably see that continuing in the next 3 to 5 years.
If I understood you correctly, in some sense, you are saying that some of the technology that will be widespread in office work in 5 years, that essentially are around now. It's just a question of diffusion that will take this like 5 years to get there.
That's for the bulk of people. That's exactly what we're going to see. It just takes a surprisingly long time. I mean, many of your listeners may have heard the story of how electricity took 30 to 40 years from its invention and early adoption in factories in the 1880s till about the 1920s before you saw really big productivity gains. And what happened in between was that at first people were just using electricity to replace steam engines, but basically doing all their work the same way as before. It took a generation before they reinvented the factory and started having, instead of one big central power source, a bunch of smaller motors, each electrically powered, that were distributed throughout the factory over a single story. And the flow of materials is what dictated the placement of the machines. That second approach led to a doubling or tripling of productivity. But it wasn't the electricity by itself that enabled that. It was a combination of electricity with new ways of working. We see the same thing in my research with the introduction of computers, or going back earlier to the steam engine. And I think we're going to see it with AI as well.
I see. Yeah, so I think also people talk about like the faster horse kind of. Just like people just can take what they have and just have very obvious extrapolation of that, but that's not how the diffusion usually happens.
No, exactly. You know, Henry Ford famously said that if he had asked his customers what they wanted, they would have said a faster horse. And it's hard for them to imagine, you know, suburbs and supermarkets and highways and all the other things that have emerged since then. And today, I'm not sure, but there's a debate going on about humanoid robots, where we see robots that have the same form factor as humans. And the advantage is then they can open doorknobs, they can use a knife and a fork and all the other things that are made for humans. And I think there's an argument that the world is made for the humanoid form factor. But also, I think it could fall into the faster horse fallacy and not really take advantage of the amazing capabilities that machines have. I mean, after all, wheels are a lot better than legs for getting around, so why don't we use them? And there's a lot of other ways of picking things up. In Amazon factories, sometimes they use suction cups and other tools for grabbing things that work better than our five fingers.
Yeah, so similarly, like, why do we need a robot that will wash the dishes? We have a dishwasher already, right? So it's actually quite efficient in doing that.
It's very efficient in doing that. I hear both sides. So I'm more of a connoisseur of these arguments. The other side of it is that if you have one piece of hardware, you can have it do many, many different kinds of tasks just with software. And the same thing that washes dishes could also mop the floor or wash the windows or even drive a car. I heard Andrei Karpathy have sort of a nightmare vision where his self-driving cars ended up being driven by humanoid robots instead of the software that he's designing.
Okay. So this is, of course, we don't know how exactly it will happen, but these are all, I would say, positive futures. That, like, there will be some productivity, some new possibilities that technology enables.
Right.
But, well, we all hope that this is how the future unfolds, but some worry that there will be different paths in which things unfold, maybe less optimistic ones. Maybe it will all fizzle out. Maybe there will be no much growth as we imagine. So I believe you made this bet with Robert Gordon about that. So can you tell us about this version? What was this bet about?
Well, let me just step back about the pessimism. I mean, we've all seen that technologies can be overhyped. And right now, there's an awful lot of hype about AI, you know, AI-powered, you know, vacuum cleaners or whatever, stuff that it's really not so clear that it's beneficial for that application.
Roomba, right?
No, Roomba, you know, there are things you can do here and there. And it's not necessarily the biggest, most important user. And some of them are just complete nonsense. But there also is a real core of value there. And there's a question as to whether or not this is mostly hype or mostly real. I'm quite convinced that it's real. It's mostly real, even if there is a lot of hype around the edges. I lived through an AI winter. You know, the first AI course I taught was in 1985, where I taught a course on expert systems at Harvard Extension School and another course on applications of AI. I taught it for 8 years. I had a lot of fun. We were building rule-based systems that could solve simple tasks. People had great optimism that eventually you could, you know, have all kinds of expertise captured this way. As it turns out, it didn't scale, and it just wasn't something that was able to go much beyond those initial applications that we were doing. And that led to what people have called an AI winter, where there was just a investment was drying up and a lot of companies went under. And the fear is that that will happen again. I don't think so. I think that these technologies, we're not going to see another AI winter. It may go a little faster, go a little bit slower, but there's so many people and there's so many fundamental breakthroughs we've already seen that haven't fully diffused, that we have a lot of room rate ahead of us. And I did make this bet with Bob Gordon. Let me tell you a little bit about that. Bob Gordon's one of the greatest economists. He wrote a wonderful book about the rise and fall of American productivity. And I agree with him on a lot of things. I agree with him about history. He's very good at describing that. I disagree with him about the future. He's a pessimist and doesn't think that AI is going to measure up to the great inventions of the past, like, you know, the internal combustion engine or electricity that we were talking about. So we made a bet that in the 2020s, this 10-year period, that I said that productivity was going to grow faster than what the Congressional Budget Office said. The CBO predicts 1.4% productivity growth per year. And just to be fair to him, I said, let's make it 1.8%. I'll give you 0.4%. And he bet that it's going to be less than that. And we'll find out in 2029 who is right. But I'm already ahead of the curve, right? The past three quarters have been quite good. So productivity has been a bit above trend. And I don't even think AI has really kicked in yet. I just got that for free. The real payoff is going to be in a few years when we do start seeing AI affecting the economy.
So actually, today, I really would like to dig a bit more into that, but this was a great overview. So, but you know, to do that properly, let's kind of take a step back and think about, again, this question of how will technology impact productivity and labor? Yes. Again, this is not a new question at all. And actually, you spend, as you already mentioned, decades studying it. So essentially, you were actually one of the early researchers that looked into impact of information technology on productivity. Mm-hmm. And I would say you were optimistic about AI before it was cool to be optimistic about AI.
I was. Although I was a little bit wrong. I was a little bit early, to be fair.
Well, I guess there is the saying that the only thing to be like late is to be early. But I think you worked out quite well here. So can you tell me a little bit, you know, how do you approach studying some kind of questions when you have a technology and you want to understand its impact on labor, on growth, and so on?
Well, there's different layers to look at. And one thing you can do is look at specific tasks. So working with Tom Mitchell and with Daniel Rock, we have pioneered what we call the task-based approach. And the idea here is to break down the entire economy into industries, into occupations, and then occupations down into individual tasks. So every job can be broken down into individual tasks. So a radiologist, for instance, one that Jeff Hinton talks about, radiologists being replaced by machine learning. And I think he focuses on one of the tasks radiologists do, which is reading medical images. But according to ONET, in our research, there are about 27 distinct tasks that radiologists do. They also sometimes do physical exams. They consult with other doctors. They give patient advice. Some of these AI can help a great deal with. Others it doesn't help with. And if you look at the whole set of tasks, what you find is that AI in no occupation just runs the table and is able to do all the tasks of that occupation. But in almost every occupation, it's able to do some tasks. Now, diving deeper, I've done research where I study those specific tasks that AI is affecting. For instance, with Lindsay Raymond and Daniel Lee, we did a study of call centers. And we found that a company called Cresta introduced a LLM-based tool to help call center operators. And I think it's worth going in a little bit of depth in this, if I can, because it's illustrative not just of that case, but it illustrates a lot of principles we've seen. So in the call center, they did not seek to replace the workers. Instead, the call center LLM gave advice to the operators about how to answer questions. And sometimes the operators took the advice and sometimes they didn't follow it. But the great thing for me, my point as a researcher, was that they rolled it out in a phased way. They did some A-B tests and then they rolled it out over time. So we could get causal inference about what happens when the technology is used by the operators and what happens when it's not used by it. What we found was just eye-popping. Unlike the electricity example I talked earlier, where it took, you know, decades, in this case, it was just a matter of months. Within 4 to 5 months, there was a huge improvement in performance by the operators who had access to the technology. The number of calls they could handle per hour went up by as much as 35%. Customer satisfaction went up by net promoter scores. Customer sentiment went up. You can look at all the transcripts, the millions of transcripts that we had. And what we found was that there were a lot more happy words and a lot fewer angry words in those transcripts. And even the operators themselves were happier. I was worried this would be like an electronic sweatshop that was squeezing them. But in fact, the operators liked the system and they were less likely to quit when they were working with the system than the people who weren't working with the system. So really all three groups, the stockholders, the customers, and the operators, the workers, all were better off with this technology. I've been studying these technologies for decades. I've never seen a technology have such a quick impact so quickly on a particular task. Now, since we did that study, a number of other people have done other studies of coding where the gains are often even larger, for management consulting and advising, where there's not only gains in productivity, but also in quality, in writing, in sales, in many other areas. So we're seeing a lot of specific tasks improve rapidly. Now, the other level of analysis is bringing up to the whole economy, because individual tasks are great, but how does it aggregate? And what you can do there is apply an economic concept called Hulton's theorem, which is basically the simple way of thinking about it is you look at how much productivity there is in an individual task, and then you look at how many different tasks, what percentage of the economy is affected. If you multiply those two numbers together, you get a rough estimate of how much of the economy is likely to be affected. And when we do that, I get pretty optimistic that there's a lot of tasks in the economy that are like that call center or like the coding or like the management consulting, could be 30, 40, even 50% of the economy with these kinds of cognitive language-based tasks. And that suggests that just the existing technology could really move the dial. So to put a number on it, the productivity gains in the past decade was about 1.4% per year. That's where the Congressional mm-hmm. Budget Office got that baseline. They just, to be frank, they basically look at the past years and extrapolate them.
That's how you extrapolate.
Right. No, that's, and you could do that. I like to go and look at the core technology and not just assume that the past is a prediction of the future. But when you look at the actual changes, I see that it could double that very plausibly, which would bring it up to closer to 3% per year. If that comes true, the good news is that it solves a lot of the problems that we're facing, or at least it mitigates them. Social Security, we have a big deficit coming ahead of us as the population ages and because, our promised benefits don't equal the taxes that we expect to collect. Medicare and Medicare, there's environmental problems. There are a lot of other challenges we have in our society, poverty, that become much easier to address if we have more productivity, yes, more economic growth.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I just want to double click on something, two things you said. Yeah. One is just thinking of jobs as like at the level of tasks as opposed, yes, to the whole jobs. And yes, also, yes, as much as I respect Hinton a lot for all the brilliant things he did. Yeah, this was probably an unfortunate prediction of his. I think he said that in 5 years from now, we should essentially stop educating radiologists because 5 years from now they will be out of job. This was like 2017, so clearly,
He did say that. Obviously, he's a genius. He's one of the godfathers of deep learning, and the reason that this is all happening. On economics, I don't think he got things quite right. He hadn't thought through about all of these different implications. And I went and checked after he made that quote. And, 5 years later, it turned out that we had almost double the number of job postings for radiologists. So it wasn't that they didn't go down. They actually went up quite a bit. And a part of it is because of what we said, that radiologists do many things. Another part of it is that the technology is slower to adopt. And a third thing is that this is a little counterintuitive to people, but that when the price of something goes down, sometimes spending goes up.
Yes.
And that has to do with the slope of the demand curve. A downward sloping demand curve means that lower price leads to greater quantity. Yeah. If the quantity increases faster than the price falls, spending goes up. And to give you an intuitive example of that, when jet engines were introduced and pilots became vastly more productive and the cost per passenger mile went down tremendously, that did not lead to fewer pilots being hired.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously led to a lot more pilots being hired. And that happens a lot in the economy. It, in fact, it happens more often than not.
Yeah, the term is the elasticity of demand or something like that.
That's exactly right. Elasticity of demand. It's the change in the quantity divided by the change in the price or the percentage change in each. And if that is greater than one, then you're going to have more spending overall. And there are many goods, not every good, but many goods are very elastic. And that means that the quantity grows. And, if you want to get a sense of intuitive what's happening in the economy, we're close to record low unemployment in the U.S. economy right now. But we have more amazing technologies than we've ever had in history, more labor-saving technologies. How can that be? Well, it's because on average, we're consuming more of many different things than we did 10 years ago or 50 years ago or 200 years ago.
Great. So when we are at the topic of terminology, the other interesting term is GPT, but it's not the GPT that yes. the OpenAI talk about. It's a GPT, which is yes. So there is this like wonderful paper with a title, GPTs are GPTs.
Yes.
So essentially, yes. So what is GPT in the economic terms and to what extent ChatGPT is a GPT?
Still grumpy about that. GPTs was our acronym, The Economist. When we referred to GPTs, we referred to general purpose technologies. And that includes electricity, the steam engine, computers, and I think AI. Most people would agree AI are general purpose technologies. Most economic growth comes from technology, but it comes from a particular class of technologies, which are general purpose technologies. These are technologies that don't just affect one little thing, like a better kind of a coffee cup. They are technologies that spill across many sectors. And most importantly, they lead to complementary innovations that build on top of them. So electricity led to, lights that we have here and air conditioning and electric motors and lots of other things, electronics. So GPTs have all these spin-on inventions and innovations. AI is leading to all sorts of spin-off innovations as well. And that's why we think of AI as a GPT. And that GPT's paper, great paper written by some folks at OpenAI. And yes. I also get a tiny bit of credit because one of my students, my former student, Daniel Rock, was a co-author on that paper. He's now a professor at Wharton, but he worked with me at MIT. And I thought it was a brilliant piece that looked at all the different tasks that were affected and how generative pre-trained transformers are a kind of general purpose technology.
Yes, so that was wonderful. Also, this shows you between Hinton and now this terminology shows you that the AI folks do not read much of economics. I hope this will change.
It shows that. It also shows that if you don't want to go head-to-head with the AI folks because their acronym is going to win.
Yeah, that probably now it looks like you are trying to repurpose this acronym because it's popular. But yeah, I think that's fine. So, okay. Let's talk a little bit more about how you think AI will impact positively our productivity in our lives.
Yes.
So again, as you already said, you were early to this and you wrote two books. I think this was like Race Against the Machines and the Second Machine Age, and which kind of writes about this positive future. And there's a very important concept there about AI being not the substitute, but complement.
Yes.
So, and you talk about things like Turing trap. So could you tell us more about
that? Yeah, thank you for highlighting this, because I think probably the biggest misconception that, I run to, you know, as an economist, is this assumption that AI is going to take all the jobs and that AI is a perfect substitute for humans. And it's true that sometimes AI does substitute for people, but more often than not, it ends up being a complement. Substitute is when something replaces something. Complement is when it makes it more valuable. If you look at through most of history, technologies have been both, but the more important thing has been AI as a complement. And one way to see that is that think of how valuable is 1 hour of human labor. It's gotten more and more valuable over time. You know, in 1700, it really wasn't that valuable. In 1800, 1900, today it's more valuable than ever before. Why? Because it is complemented with technologies. You know, if you're digging a ditch, you have a bulldozer or a steam engine that can lift things. If you're writing software, you have computers that can help you create software faster than ever. So an hour of labor can create far more value than before because of these technological complements. It's also true for AI that in most businesses, like in the call center example, you get more value by using the AI to complement human workers than trying to replace it. And part of that is because brilliant as the machine learning folks are, they haven't been able to make machines that can do the full set of things that humans can do. And so typically, when you're trying to solve a problem, AI can do parts of it, but humans are still needed for other parts of it. Like in the call center example, we looked at all the different call questions that were asked, and there's some questions that are asked very frequently, like, how do I change my password? You know, how I'm locked out. And there are other questions, there's this long tail of questions that only appear once in the data, you know, some complicated tax question or something that just has never been seen before. It turns out, not surprising, that machine learning is good at things where there's a lot of data. You need data to do machine learning. So those common questions, they have some really good, crisp answers for. But that long tail of unusual questions, AI, machine learning can't help much with those. But we humans, actually, we're pretty good. We kind of muddled our way through. We haven't seen the exact question before. So there's a natural division of labor there. And we see this over and over, that combining the two leads to better outcomes than having just one on its own.
So yeah, this is very interesting, but like there is a little bit of a problem here. Like in a sense, if we think about how we train AI systems, the way these models are trained is to be the substitutes. Yes, their job is to be substitute.
For a piece of it, yeah.
Yes, so then it turns out that they end up being kind of complements too, and that's what we are especially after. So like, do you have any advice how to design systems that really have this like being a complement in mind?
I wish there was more conscious intention. You're right. I think that a lot of machine learning researchers think of it primarily as a substitute. And it's partly because of the inspiration of the great Alan Turing, you know, one of the first real computer scientists. And he was speculating in 1950, like, how could we even know if a machine was intelligent? And he came up with a test, which was, well, imagine you have a room, two rooms, one with a computer and one with a human, and you ask them each questions, maybe like with a teletype, you know, printed. And if you couldn't tell which was which, then the machine was considered intelligent. That became known as the Turing test. I think it was a very cool test. And when I was a kid, I thought it was like a great test of intelligence. Now I think it's a terrible test. It really misses the point. It's about as good a test of intelligence as if you saw a magician levitating a woman would be a test of whether you'd solved gravity. I think that people are easy to be fooled. They can be fooled by AI programs. They can be fooled by magicians. The other problem with the Turing test is it's led a whole generation, couple of generations of machine learning and AI researchers to try to make machines that perfectly replicate humans. They think that the standard is if you can imitate a human perfectly, then you've created a great technological breakthrough. It is kind of cool to do that, but from an economist's perspective, it's exactly the wrong goal. And now we're kind of like the dog that was chasing the car and finally caught it. Now what do you do? I think we are making machines that replicate humans in many ways and can pass the Turing test. But from an economist's perspective, there's two fundamental problems with this, and that leads to what I call the Turing trap. The first is that in many ways, it's actually not ambitious enough, because simply replicating human skills is, I mean, it sounds ambitious, but in many ways, we should have machines that do a lot more than that. I mean, it would be very lame if Henry Ford said, I'm going to make a car that can, you know, walk as fast as a human or run as fast as a human. Cars can do much more, and machines can do much more intellectually than humans do. So we should set a higher goal. The second issue is that it leads to a concentration of wealth and power. If you make a machine that replicates what human workers do, then it tends to be a substitute, and that leads to a concentration of wealth and power. If you make a machine that complements humans, that is to do things differently than humans and make the human skills more valuable and do other things that the humans can't do, well, that tends to make labor more valuable instead of less valuable. Why would you want labor to be more valuable? Well, it leads to more widely dispersed wealth and ultimately power. So if you want to have not just prosperity but shared prosperity, you should favor complements rather than substitutes. I think machine learning researchers can consciously work harder to think about how can we make machines that help humans as opposed to replace them. For instance, one thing would be to work harder on explainability so that when a machine makes a recommendation, the human can critique it and say, oh, you know, I agree with that part, I disagree with that part, and then the human and machine can work more effectively. I mean, think of an AI doctor that said, you know, looking at all the data, I think you should cut the patient's left leg off. I think a lot of doctors would sort of say, well, wait a minute. And the machine says, oh, I'm right 98% of the time. I think the doctor would still hesitate a bit and say, I'm not sure I want to do this. On the other hand, if the machine explained what it was doing, it would be more of a compliment, and then the doctor could bring her own or his own knowledge to bear, and the two of them together could make better decisions. Maybe sometimes they go along with that decision, other times they decide to overrule it. That's one example of how machines can be complements rather than substitutes.
Yeah, so I agree with all of that. And in particular, like, I really find it surprising, or maybe not surprising, that like how relatively narrow the people's thinking about how AI can be useful in a given context is, because exactly, they can be your coach, they can be your muse, they can be like your kind of take a first pass at a task and so on. So there's all this richness. So for now, we kind of need to do this matching on case-by-case basis. I believe you have a company, WorkHelix, that kind of tries to do it and tries to figure out this thing. So tell me more about that.
Well, WorkHelix is very much inspired by this, what I've just been saying, that you can use the technology to amplify and enhance human capabilities, and that if you do it that way, you can unlock a lot of economic potential and a lot of productivity. So WorkHelix takes the task-based approach that I described earlier, goes through any organization's tasks, up to 200,000 individual tasks for company, and each company gets a unique, you know, sort of fingerprint of where AI can help it the most, but in particular, where AI can augment their workforce and make them more effective, produce higher quality, produce new goods and services, higher customer satisfaction. And that's not just because we want to be nice to workers. It's good to be nice to workers, but also because it ultimately creates more value. That if you do it that way, you're more likely to have a system that's robust and successful than if you try to have a system that all by itself solves problems. It's just really hard to have systems. You know, you see that like with self-driving cars, how hard it's been to make a car that works in all different situations. It's much easier to have one that sort of supports human workers or human drivers. And same thing with the call center, same thing with the radiologist. In case after case, having it complement creates more value. WorkHelix is now working with lots of Fortune 500 companies to create a roadmap of where they get those opportunities. And the timing has turned out great because right now, almost every board of directors is asking almost every CEO, what is our roadmap? What is our game plan for generative AI? And they're, a lot of them are floundering. They hear all this hype. They hear this noise. They hear stories about AI. They don't know what's real and what's not. So WorkHelix provides a data-driven approach to analyzing all of those tasks and prioritizing which ones are the best ones to go after initially.
Yeah, so just to double-click on something you said, it's about the self-driving cars that people obviously, and I like get excited about self-driving cars and why we are not there, although way more cars in San Francisco seem to work surprisingly.
They're pretty good. I do like them. Yeah, I've ridden around in them. Yeah.
But definitely we are not where we wanted to do. But in the meantime, in part because of this drive, we have all these things like essentially in our normal cars that help us like keep the lanes and all of that. There's actually a lot of AI in that.
Right.
It may be not the most sexy AI, but actually this is something that makes a difference.
It makes it safer. It warns us. Exactly. I mean, I first drove in a Waymo self-driving car. No, it wasn't a Waymo. It was a Google self-driving car back then. In 2012, we rode from Mountain View up to San Francisco, Andy McAfee and I. And I thought, oh, wow, it's just around the corner. We're practically there. It turned out to be a lot harder. And as your listeners may know, there's actually 6 levels of self-driving, from 0, where there's none, all the way to level 5, where it's full automation. And we really don't have a lot of level 5, if any. You know, in San Francisco, if it drives less than 25 miles per hour, it is pretty good. But mostly we're in those middle categories, and they all involve different levels of human and machine working together. And one of the projects I'm working on is thinking about those different levels of human and machine cooperation. How can you apply them to other tasks? I mean, there's some like chess where we've zipped through all of the different levels, and now computers really can do everything. But almost everything we do in the world is a lot more complicated than, you know, 8 black and white squares by 8 black and white squares, you know, 64 altogether. And so in the rest of the tasks that people are doing, it's more often than not that humans and machines can work better together than just one of them. And that's where this task-based analysis focuses.
Yes, this makes sense. By the way, just again, we are a bit nerding out about the self-driving cars, but let's do it. It's just the other concept here is also not the notion of a self-driving car, but a driverless car, which means actually human is still involved in driving the car, but maybe there's one human overseeing 10 different cars. Mm-hmm. So you are just like reducing the number of drivers per car, but like it's not fully self-driving. Yeah. And again, even there are a lot of possibilities.
Well, it helps with the edge cases. So, you know, we were talking earlier about this long tail where there's some common cases and some less common cases. And machine learning doesn't often see those unusual cases. I was in a Waymo car in San Francisco. I got in the car with Sebastian Thrun, who really, founded the field. We happened to be at a party, and we both got into the same Waymo car because we're friends. The car was parked, but then before we got out, a human driver pulled up in front and kind of blocked us in. It was sort of like halfway covering the car, so our Waymo car couldn't get out. Onto the road. And it was kind of stuck there for about like a minute or two, and we didn't know what to do. There's no driver in the car. And then a human driver called in, our human operator called in remotely and figured out what was happening, and we explained how we were blocked in by this other car. Luckily, just as we were talking to him for like 10 seconds, that other car pulled away, and then we were able to get out. But it's a good example of how this weird case was not something in the training data, didn't know what to do, but a human could deal with it. And so that division of labor was very helpful.
Yes, sounds good. So, okay, so I understand what is the bullish case for like the productivity enhancement of AI, but it's kind of mostly based on the complements. The other way in which I am hopeful about AI leading to more productivity is by creating new science, new innovation. So what are your views about that?
I'm so excited about that. So this is where the really big payoff comes, is if we can use AI and machine learning to boost science and innovation, to create new things that have never been seen before. A lot of what AI is doing is replicating what we already have, doing it more efficiently, capturing the knowledge from the good call center operators and making it accessible to the less skilled call center operators. But AI potentially can also boost creativity and innovation. It can lead to new kinds of understand protein folding. It can lead to new materials, and even new scientific discovery by reading through all the papers that have been published and finding gaps and opportunities. Tomorrow in my class at Stanford, I teach a class called the AI Awakening. We're having Anima.
Great title.
We're having Anima Anunkuma, a Caltech professor, used to be at NVIDIA. She's going to be talking about exactly this AI for scientific discovery. What's exciting about that is that it doesn't just raise the level of productivity, but it changes the growth rate. It allows us to start having new inventions and a faster pace of scientific discovery. So we start going on a faster trajectory as well as a higher level.
Yeah, that's definitely the positive case. But now, remembering that the world is not so rosy always, let's think a little bit about the potential negative aspects. So, of course, we already touched on this briefly. Like, one, there is a lot of concern about how this disruption caused by AI will affect our existing jobs and how will society react to it. And again, this is not the first time this happened in the history of humanity. We have ludits that emerged at some point. So how do you think this analogy to what happened during the first machine revolution like will be apt today?
Well, we need to pay attention because, you know, people denigrate the Luddites, but it is actually true that many of them were de-skilled and did lose their jobs. And there was a period where workers did not get a big part of the gains. You know, you have to go back to the 1820s when the Luddites were smashing machines. Just earlier in the 21st century, you know, globalization was spreading and China was joining the World Trade Organization. And economists like me were saying, hey, look, you know, free trade makes the pie bigger. It makes us all richer. We get gains from trade. You know, there's theorems about this. Of course, it doesn't guarantee that everyone's automatically going to win. There's going to be winners and losers, but that's easy to fix. If the pie is bigger, that means we have more wealth so we can compensate people and make sure that everyone comes out ahead if you redistribute some of the gains and compensate people. Well, as it turns out, we did the first half of that, but not the second half. So we did do globalization, but the people in Michigan and North Carolina and elsewhere that lost their jobs, by and large, ended up being worse off than before. And that led to a huge backlash. And so over the past 10 years, there's been a lot of resentment and populism by people who were hurt by globalization. And now a lot of Americans and Europeans and others are opposed to free trade, and they're pushing back on it. So we have higher tariffs, both by Trump and by Biden. And I think it's a big failure of us economists to make sure we did both parts of that. I worry that we're going to have a replay of that right now, where technology also can make the pie bigger, but there are winners and losers. There's no economic law that says everyone's going to benefit or even that everyone is not going to fall behind. You could have some people being made worse off while other people gain. If that happens again, there will be a tech backlash. And there could be more concentration of wealth and power, and those people who are made worse off are going to be pretty angry, and I wouldn't blame them. And their first instinct is going to be to oppose technology in general, when really what we should be doing is opposing the misuse of technology to lead to this concentration. Done right, it can lead to shared prosperity, but if we put it on autopilot and just assume it's going to work out, there's no guarantee it will. I worry about the politics of that. I worry about the economics of that. And I think we have to be very conscious about using the technology in a way that it does lead to shared prosperity.
Yeah, so I absolutely agree with this view that, yes, this like make the grow the pie philosophy works as long as you do the both parts of this philosophy. And the second part tends to somehow always be delayed or never executed or like silent. So again, as you say, it's very important we get it right this time, especially with such a consequential
technology. The stakes are higher and higher.
Exactly. Yes. So what could you like recommend we do to prepare for that? So we don't react to this, but actually we prepare for that.
Well, you know, you mentioned briefly my earlier paper, The Turing Trap, where I warned about that if we try to make technology that imitates humans, it could lead to a concentration on wealth and power. And that's a trap because once those people have lost their wealth and power, it's hard for them to fix that. By definition, they don't have the power that they did before. So there's a few things we can do to try to avoid that. And I really think of three different groups that could be affected. The first is technologists. And so they're inventing a lot of these technologies. I've been amazed by how able they are to hit targets once you set them. So we just came out with the AI Index report. We have a whole bunch of benchmarks in there. And one of the problems with the benchmarks is that technologies are so good, they hit them just a year or even months after they're created. But that's good news too. If we have a benchmark of like, hey, let's make AI that complements humans rather than substitutes it, let's think about ways of creating shared prosperity. I think a technologist, many of them would be very willing to do that. I've talked to them and said, oh, that's what you want us to do? Yeah, we can do that. You should have told us. As opposed to this image that Alan Turing put up of let's make technology that imitates. So it's a different, and not just Alan Turing. In fairness, there have been a number of people, Nielsen and others, that have described technology that replaces humans as sort of the definition of strong AI. People like Doug Engelbart talked about AI that complemented people or intelligence augmentation. So there's things we can do on that that's mostly, I think, cultural, to be frank. There's a second group, which is managers that I spend a lot of time with and entrepreneurs, and they're looking at AI to increase productivity. And too often, I think it's just a failure of imagination. They're looking at AI that can go into existing business process and replace each of the people with a machine, because that's sort of the simplest thing, is how can we take the labor out? And yes, that will lead to higher profits, lower costs, but it doesn't really get as much of a benefit as they would get from rethinking the process. Like I mentioned earlier, that you know, Jeff Bezos reinvented retailing. And part of it also has to do with the incentives there, that if they make the company more productive, that's good for them, that's good for the workers. If they replace labor with capital, that helps them and it helps the workers. So it's kind of the replacing labor with capital is a bit of a zero-sum game that they're the winners of. And there's no real benefit to society from shifting the value around like that. So we need to straighten out the incentives and create more imagination about how to do that. And that's what I do when I teach, you know, in the business school. I teach managers. I ask them to think more creative, think outside the box, not just replacing workers, but also doing new things. And then the final group that I think needs attention, I just came back from Washington, D.C. I was in the White House talking to the Council of Economic Advisors, Capitol Hill, is changing our policy in ways that support this more widely shared prosperity. We actually have a lot of policies in place right now that intentionally or unintentionally drive entrepreneurs and drive work towards replacement rather than helping workers. So for instance, capital taxes are about half of what they are on labor on the margin. And so if you are an entrepreneur or manager thinking of a new business, and you can either do it with, you know, 1,000 workers or 1,000 machines, the government is saying your tax will be lower if you do it with the machines than with the workers. Effectively, the government has its thumb on the scale, steering a lot of our economics in one particular direction. I don't think there's any particular rationale for steering it in that way to against workers and towards capital, but that's what's happening right now. Maybe it didn't make a big difference when the technology wasn't that powerful, but now we really have very powerful technologies and our policies are not having a level playing field the way they could. So all three of those groups, the technologists, the manager and entrepreneurs, the policymakers, they all have misaligned incentives and could be doing things a little bit differently. If we address those gaps, I think we would get out of the Turing trap. We would be more likely to have AI that augments workers and less likely to have this increasing concentration of wealth and power.
Yeah, so these are great points. And actually, again, you touched on a lot of things that only once you really look deeper, they start to pop up, because at the high level, everything looks right. So just to touch on this manager's point. So this is one of my, like, the point I do when I talk to managers is, well, think about incentives also of your employees. Yeah? So you say the real benefit from AI is not just by like point-wise automation.
Yes.
It's actually by rethinking the task around AI.
Right.
Well, who will be the best in figuring out what is the way to rethink best the task? Well, people who are actually like working on this task. So this would be the radiologist or whoever you currently are thinking of replacing. But like, yes, if you are thinking of replacing them, what is the incentive for them to help you in this context? It's like, how many radiologists will be happily work with you to kind of put them out of work?
You're totally right that the workers know best where these opportunities are, and you want to have them on your side. You don't want to make it adversarial. If you bring them in and say, help us understand the ways that this technology can help, it'll create far more value. But then you have to make sure the incentives are aligned, that they're not going to lose their jobs from doing it. You know, I was talking to one of my MIT colleagues, Regina Barzilay. She's a brilliant AI researcher, and she developed a tool for better recognizing breast cancer. Yeah. She was trying to introduce it to hospitals, and she was getting a lot of resistance. And I talked to her, and she had really was kind of positioning it as replacing radiologists. And the approach that would have been better would be to say, hey, this can help you do your job better. It can help you get better quality. You can have better patient care, and ultimately maybe even do more imaging than you ever did before and expand your service, maybe even have more radiologists by what we were talking about earlier, the elasticity. Likewise, when companies adopt this, I think that they don't necessarily have to have any reduction in force, even if it makes it more productive. Not only do you have high demand elasticity, but you know, the reality is that the early adopters tend to grow. It's the late adopters that tend to lag behind. So the best thing for your own workers is to be on the leading edge of these technologies, show them that this can make their jobs more effective, and help that company win market share overall.
That's a great way to put it. So by the way, just because this comes up over and over and people think about the like shared benefits of more productivity, so will our work days, work weeks get shorter?
I think they will. It'll be a choice, though. I mean, and I think that's a great way to get some of the benefits. You know, in Norway, they're much wealthier in many ways, partly because of their oil wealth, also because they're very productive workers. And they have shortened the work week. Or even the United States. I mean, the work week was closer to 60 hours a week a century ago. And John Maynard Keynes talked about the work week shortening. He thought it'd go all the way down to 15 hours. That hasn't happened. But it is. It has steadily shortened over the past number of decades. It may not seem like it, but if you look at the data, the official work week or the effective work week has shortened quite a bit. I expect that will continue to happen. You know, the essence of it is that as we get wealthier, and we are getting wealthier, even if, you know, again, if it doesn't seem like it, but by every metric in terms of, you know, the size of our houses, the years of life living, the consumption of just about everything, we're wealthier. One of the things that people like to consume more of is leisure. And on the margin, they spend a little bit less time working. Most people do. I happen to love my job, so I don't mind what I do, what they call work. And some people like that too. But the option will be there to be able to pay for food and clothing without working as many hours as we used to.
Okay, so this is the positive future. Mm-hmm. But again, some of your colleagues might not be as optimistic as you. Mm-hmm. So if you think about this other prognosis for the future, like the AI-enabled future of work, like why are their predictions different to you? Like what do you think they're overlooking or discounting?
Well, there's two kinds of pessimism, and I'm happy to talk about either of them or both of them. One is that the technology doesn't take off. Mm-hmm. And so there are those people who look at what we have and they just don't think it's going to move the dial a whole lot. And then there are also people who do think it's going to move the dial a lot, but they think it's going to move it in a bad way. So which would you prefer I speak to?
Actually,
first?
Both of them.
Okay. So on the technology, I mean, that is a question that you need to talk to technologists about. I don't think you can just extrapolate from the past the way the Congressional Budget Office does. I mean, I don't blame them for doing that. But, you know, if you really want to get into the nuts and bolts of what's happening, you have to understand the technology in a little bit more depth. And the breakthroughs we've had, especially in the past few years where transformers and LLMs are being much more widely adopted, the ability to solve a lot of problems that just weren't solvable before is breathtaking. And if you talk to the leading AI researchers, you know, almost all of them will say they're genuinely surprised by how well it's working. Demis Hassabis at Google, or you know, Greg Brockman or Mira at OpenAI or others are really impressed with what these models are able to do and what they expect them to be able to do going forward. So that's a cause for optimism. Even if the technology froze right now, I still think there'd be productivity gains just implementing what they're already capable of. So that's my role for optimism. I think that most of the economists who aren't as optimistic, and this is going to sound a little harsh, but I just don't think they've spent as much time with the technology. I go to the East Coast and some of the leading government officials or others, they just literally haven't seen what the technology can do. I think as they get exposed to it, they all update, as I've updated, in the direction of more optimism about what the technology can do.
Yeah, so sadly, that's actually true. I was quite shocked to see pretty senior policymakers who are in charge of deciding the future of the technology, mm-hmm. who have not ever interacted with it. They just like.
I mean, I went in, I'm not going to name names, but I went and met with a senior person and I said, look, the first thing you need to do is just start playing with it yourself. A, it's going to help you do your job better. Yeah. I mean, it's literally going to be useful to you. And B, you know, you need to be able to have firsthand experience with it. And one of the great things about the latest generation of technology, by the way, is you don't need a lot of specialized skills. You don't have to learn Python or electrical engineering or anything. You can just interact in English, as you know. And so there's really no excuse for not playing around with it and probably getting some productivity gains in your own work pretty quickly. So as more people start doing that, I think we'll see more people coming to the view that these technologies can have a big impact. I mean, a related problem is that I've noticed this. I've got some good friends, very smart friends that went to top universities who are also skeptical. And listening to them, I realized that there's just a lot of hype and nonsense out there as well. And so while I'm spending a lot of time talking to real technologists, if you're 3,000 miles away, there's a whole lot of people who know nothing about the technology but will say a lot about it and are just on the bandwagon. And like with cryptocurrencies and some other overhyped technologies, you know, these hypesters drown out the real technologists. And so that leads to a lot of skepticism out there. And hopefully over time, you know, the genuine technology breakthroughs will become more apparent. Every time I talk to a CEO or a manager, or I ask them, you know, encourage them to use the technology. So it's evangelizing. I mean, to be fair, it's a relatively new technology. These things take time to diffuse. In many ways, it's remarkable how fast it has diffused. So, you know, we shouldn't be overly impatient. I'd love it to happen faster, but it's still happening pretty fast compared to many earlier technologies. Things just take time. So I think that the cure is already in the pipeline, that we will start seeing more and more people be moved by these technologies, more and more companies adopt them. My company, WorkHelix, has this mission to make it more accessible to a lot more companies and help them identify where the opportunities are, and also, equally important, which ones are hype and which ones they should avoid. So I think we're going to see it diffusing a lot more rapidly in the coming years. And so I think it's... I'm not too worried about that. It will happen. We will have those gains in the coming years. Every year you get more computer power for the same number of dollars. In fact, it was about 20-25% more per year. So when I plotted it, these numbers were just these real adoption of computer power were just skyrocketing. Every industry, I traced it across different industries, different occupations, and there are all these like exponentially growing curves of computer adoption. And I looked at that, like a lot of people have looked at similar kinds of curves, you know, Bill Gates and others, and said, wow, this is clearly going to be a game changer here. And it was just the early stages of that happening in the 80s and then accelerated in the 90s. And every year since then, we've had more and more computer power, which I think is at the core of machine learning and a lot of other advances, that we just have more computational ability. And we have more digital data. There was very little digital data in the 80s and 90s, and now we're awash with it. These two are the lifeblood of machine learning. And so it struck me as almost inevitable that we would have improvements in our ability to solve problems. And we have. And you started seeing that in 2012. You know, that was the early stages of the deep learning revolution. ImageNet was, back to our friend Jeff Hinton, introduced deep learning techniques to recognize images, 14 Alex million Net. Images. Yeah. And that was an example. And once he did that, and once his team did that, I should say, everyone started adopting these methods. So it was the early stages. I didn't know that transformers were going to be invented or exactly what the details were going to be. But the broad trajectory was on target, just as I don't know exactly what inventions they're going to have in 2025 and 2026. But I'm pretty confident that there will be additional improvements. Although at this point, even if there weren't, just turning the crank on the scaling laws and the data would give us a lot of benefits going forward.
Okay, so we were, like, took this detour, but let's still come back to this question. Okay, so one way in which people say, you know, the AI might not be such a big thing, positive thing, was that, okay, they don't believe the technology will take off.
Right.
The other one was that it might take off, but go in the kind of not the desirable direction. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a legitimate fear, is that AI could be very powerful, but be used in dangerous ways. And I'm more worried about this than a lot of people. you know, I'm not quite in the extreme catastrophic risk camp, but I think it's a significant possibility. Again, back to this principle that we have more powerful tools than we've ever had before. And, you know, 100,000 years ago, someone might have had a spear and, like, they could throw it. Maybe they could kill a person. You know, maybe they could dent the side of a cliff a little bit. But you really couldn't change the world all that much. Then, you know, there are machine guns, atomic weapons, biological weapons. Over time, we've just gotten more and more ability to change the world in a positive way, but also, let's face it, in a negative way. And for the first time, we're beginning to have technologies that potentially could be existential at the level of wiping out, you know, a large percentage of people on Earth. They could have catastrophic effects on the economy and employment. They can have big effects on our democracy. We need to take them very seriously and start thinking about how we manage those. We want them to be used in a positive way, but we shouldn't be just blind and assume that nothing bad could happen, because with great power comes great responsibility.
Yes, I agree with that. And again, my team preparedness tries to exactly understand in as concrete terms as possible what are the risks. Yes, like what is the event, the possibility of like, what is the worst case?
Yeah.
If someone wanted to misuse this technology. So I completely resonate with this.
So, I mean, I'm an economist. So the ones that I'm especially focused on are some of the economic ones. And I think it's likely that there will be a lot of new skills needed. There's going to be a lot of job churn. I said at the beginning of our discussion that technology has always been creating jobs, has always been destroying jobs. But now the pace is going faster than ever before. The Industrial Revolution played out over a couple of hundred years. We're going to have a scale of change that's comparable or greater than the Industrial Revolution, but compressed over a couple of decades or less potentially. And that's just a lot harder to adjust to. Now, the wrong thing to do, the one thing I know we shouldn't do is try to freeze all the jobs just the way they are and try to preserve things the way they are. That always fails, but it's unfortunately the first instinct a lot of people have is like, how can we hang on to the things that were before? That's actually the riskier strategy. The safer strategy is to lean in and have a flexible economy that allows you to change jobs, allows people to move from occupation to occupation, allows people to learn new skills. It's a little uncomfortable, but it ultimately leads to more cushioning and more wealth preservation than trying to have the brittleness of keeping the jobs exactly the way they were before.
Yes, but of course, you completely understand that it's very uncomfortable to people. And also, like, there has to maybe be some helping hand.
Absolutely.
To kind of guide that and enable that. So that would be the future.
There has to be a helping hand. It also has to be a safety net.
Yes.
Because it's not always going to work for everybody. And you want to have that flexibility. You know, I was born in Denmark. And so I may be biased, but I think Denmark has a great approach. They call it flex security, where they have Danes have a pretty generous safety net, but they also, you can hire and fire people very easily. If somebody starts a business and it doesn't work out, they can just lay people off. Some of the other European countries make it very difficult to lay off or start businesses. Denmark tries to have a flexible economy and get a little bit of the best of both worlds.
That's actually, I wasn't aware of that. I did know that they have a good kind of welfare thinking, but this is that's something I knew I learned, even though I am from Europe. So
where are you from?
I'm from Poland.
So, okay. Poland's doing pretty well, actually, these days, right?
It is doing pretty well, but I think much of this was like hard earned by a lot of work. And honestly, there were some kind of casualties of this growth. The growth since the communist times was impressive, but it was not like not everyone won on this. And I think that's the
right. No, exactly. And you can never have it where everyone wins. But if you could have a safety net that cushions that, you could do a lot better than what we're doing in the United States, I'm sure. And there are those who think that a safety net is at odds with innovation and creativity and entrepreneurship. I think that's exactly backwards. I know so many people who would like to start a new company, but they're afraid to because they'd lose their health insurance. That's too risky. If you had a way that they could hang on to their health benefits and their other benefits, there would be more entrepreneurship and more dynamism and mobility.
Good. So we talk a lot about the high level picture of what the trends are. But let's try to zoom in now on the personal level. So what do you think people like? You talk quite a lot about like how AI can improve personal productivity. Mm-hmm. But what are maybe the misconceptions there? Like in what way people like don't think the right way about like taking advantage of AI for their own personal productivity?
Well, I guess a couple of things. First off, I think the biggest misconception is back to what I said before, is thinking in terms of replacement as opposed to complementing and how it can help you do new things, or thinking about it as the old kind of technology that gave you the exact correct answer, the symbolic technologies as opposed to one that, you know, sometimes may be right, sometimes may be wrong, but it is going to be creative and allow you to think about new things. The other thing is that these new technologies, I find that the on-ramp is much easier than some of the earlier technologies. You interact with them in English, and you can learn things, you can play around with them and discover things. So anyone who is sort of intimidated by technology before shouldn't be. You're not going to have to learn some arcane coding language. And that, I think, makes it much easier to explore things. The third thing is that I think people will be surprised at how much fresh territory there is and how much discovery there is. Even the top developers at OpenAI and elsewhere don't always realize what these technologies are capable of. So end users are discovering possibilities. I mean, coding itself, one probably the biggest single productivity gain from LLMs has been in allowing programmers, coders to write better software. Wasn't something they initially intended when they first used these LLMs to scrape the web. It was something that they discovered. And there are many other discoveries like that where people are using the technology to solve problems that that even the developers hadn't realized it could do.
Yeah. So by the way, just by now, if you are not using some of like Copilot technology as a programmer, you will be just behind. It's like that's
exactly. I'm not sure I coined it, but Andy and I may have been the ones who coined it. At the end of our Harvard Business Review article back in 2017, we said AI will not replace managers, but managers who use AI will replace managers who don't. And you can swap in any occupation,
yes.
You know, coders, doctors, lawyers, radiologists. If you use AI, you're going to replace the people who don't use it.
Okay. So talking about individuals, I think, again, the topic which we already touched a couple of times, but I want to make sure we really face it front and center is inequality.
Mm-hmm.
Right? By the way, the ironic thing here was that much of AI was developed with the idea of replacing lower skilled job.
Yes.
What happened is that actually we are on the ramp up to replace at least middle skill or high skill jobs, at least in some, not fully as we talk, it's about tasks. So, but anyway, just how do you see this impact of this AI change communities, in particular from the point of view of inequality? Again, who might be staying behind?
So, I don't want to be too definitive in the predictions, but, going back to the call center study we did before with Lindsay and Danielle, it was very striking how different groups were affected. It turned out that the least experienced workers and also the least skilled workers, which overlap, but we measured them separately, were the ones who benefited the most. They had about a 35% productivity gain. The most skilled workers, the top, actually had, as far as we could tell, a 0%. There's some noise around the estimates, but there was almost no gain for those. And then in between, it was sort of a smooth gradient there. So this was a technology that was compressing productivity and performance differences. And as you were saying earlier, that is actually the opposite of what earlier waves. When I wrote some of my first papers back in the late 90s and early 2000s, we talked about what economists call skill-biased technical change. And computers were leading to a bigger gap. And over most of the past 30 to 40 years, more educated, more highly paid workers have been pulling away from high school educator or high school dropouts. And that growing gap has led to more inequality in the United States and other advanced economies. And even not just economic measures, other measures like mortality, suicide, alcoholism, drug abuse, they've all sort of widened between those groups. This technology has the potential for reversing that. Ethan Mollick has some other studies that he's highlighted with management consultants where there's a similar effect. Coders, not necessarily the top, but sort of the middle ones were the ones who were benefiting. So you see it in a lot of different categories. It's still early. I don't want to make a total generalization, but at least we have the potential now for undoing some of what technology did in the past of widening inequality. And it could be that this is something that leads to more widely shared prosperity.
Yeah, so it's still early, so maybe it's too early to say two specific things of what we should do, although you already mentioned something like the tax rate on capital versus tax on labor are some of these actions. But what kind of, I would say, mindset should our society have to kind of push the future towards the positive one versus the negative?
Well, I think we need to be very proactive because these tools are very powerful, and the more powerful the tools are, the more important our values are, because we actually can steer the world more than we did in the past. It makes a difference what our choices are. So we have to decide, do we want a world where everyone participates? Do we want a world with great concentration of wealth and power, or where it's distributed wealth and power? Most people prefer the second category. And that is, it's not something that the technology decides for. It's a choice. Actually, going back to my TED Talk, what was it, in 2013, I said my last line in that TED Talk, which I still believe, is technology is not destiny. We shape our destiny. So let's think about what we want this technology to do. And I do worry that because of the scaling laws and some of the other underlying forces, that there is a tendency, if we're put it on autopilot, towards more concentration. The LLM models are getting bigger and bigger. Also, in the rest of the economy, these models are allowing people to make more centralized decision-making. A big retailer can pull in data from all over the country and make decisions and outcompete all the mom-and-pop retailers who may not be as efficient. And we're seeing the data showing, by the way, more and more concentration, not just in retailing, but also in finance, manufacturing. Every industry is having this increased concentration where the top firms are getting a bigger share. They're pulling away from the rest. That's a world that could be more efficient. Maybe it has higher productivity, but it has these negative side effects of a very skewed distribution, not just of income, but also power. And I think ultimately, I'm not a political scientist, but I think political power will tend to follow economic power, and that could be very unstable.
Yes. So actually, like, that's a great point. And to even like take it to the next level, like if you look at the geopolitical scene, right? There are countries that are developing countries. They might not even have reached even the IT information technology stage.
Right.
What do you think is the future there? Like, how can they be also winners of the AI age?
Well, I'm very concerned about that because historically, manufacturing, middle skill, low skill manufacturing has been the ticket to prosperity for these countries. So, you know, Korea, Vietnam, Philippines, even, you know, China, they rode this escalator where they did low skill manufacturing and they got more and more internal and external investment. And that raised the living standards of their people, and they sort of joined the now Korea is one of the richer countries, or Singapore. I visited them, Singapore, in the 1990s, and it was poorer than the United States. Yeah. Now it's richer than the United States. But as AI replaces a lot of those tasks that used to be done by humans, it may be harder for people in those developing countries to participate in that way. And we've seen some companies like Apple has reshored a lot of its manufacturing of Mac computers, not because labor is cheaper in the United States, but because labor is less and less of a factor in the cost structure. Again, that could be great for productivity, but it might lead to a growing inequality in the world. And growing inequality can lead to political instability.
I agree with that. And also, like, it just doesn't feel that this really benefits humanity as a whole. So what can we do to try to counteract this kind of future?
Well, so there's a couple things we can do. I mean, one that is not my favorite solution is, you know, we can do more redistribution. We can say, okay, we'll just let the system play out. The wealth gets centralized, the power gets centralized, but then we tax it and we have, UBI or foreign aid that helps people who are less well off. But I think that kind of, I'm not sure how stable that is. I'm not sure how reliable it is. Another thing we can do is try to invent technologies and push technology trajectory in a way that is more complementing humans rather than substituting for them. And that does tend to lead to more widely used technology and more prosperity that's dispersed. And neither of these, I think, is a perfect solution, but I think that second one that has it sort of, some people call it pre-distribution, that has the system itself inherently more egalitarian, is more likely to lead to outcomes. And I also suspect in the end it's going to be a more productive world because you have more people participating, you have more people contributing and inventing than just having a small core trying to do all the pushing of the frontier. So I'm encouraging my technology friends. I'm encouraging my my entrepreneurial friends. I'm encouraging my policymaker friends to think about how we can create that kind of a world where the technology is used to help people broadly. And actually, it reminds me, I actually helped co-found something called the Inclusive Innovation Challenge, which was inspired by this approach that we could use technology to innovate, but in a way that is broadly inclusive of lots of people and not just for the few.
Okay. Changing topics a bit is like something that personally is a lot on my mind is the future of like what are the right jobs to be in. Mm-hmm. During this AI transformation. So both of my daughters, they soon will enter high school and I'm really at loss. What should I advise them? Yeah. Like what career to pursue them? So what would be your advice here?
Well, My advice is be careful about any advice from me because, because it's just tricky. I'm becoming humble. In the second machine age, I had this vision, like a lot of people did, but I kind of, you know, Andy McAfee and I wrote about it, where technology was good at sort of routine, repetitive tasks and more creative work. That was something the humans were better at. And more interpersonal work was something the humans were better at. And I think that was kind of true then and was true for a number of years. But now LLMs and generative AI is flipping that around. And a lot of creative work can now be done by machines or, you know, somewhat creative and increasingly creative. And even a lot of interpersonal work. There was a study recently looking at LLMs that were answering medical questions. And they outperformed the doctors on factual knowledge. They were gave more correct answers about medical diagnoses. And, you know, that was a little bit surprising, but, you know, we're getting used to that. But the other thing was they outperformed the doctors even more on bedside manner and on connecting with the patients. They were more personable. So the doctors lost even more in that second category. And it just kind of highlighted for me that these machines, you know, they may be, reach superhuman levels of emotional intelligence even before superhuman intellect. So that advice I gave from, you know, 10 years ago is being undermined. Maybe it was good for a while. I'm switching to new advice.
But I should not follow it, so I don't know.
Well, I don't know. So my new advice is be flexible. I mean, is that, you know, be ready to make changes and don't get locked in. Don't think that, okay, I'm going to be a coder or I'm not going to be a coder or I'm going to be an English major. You know, that be adaptable. And I think that that may be where humans have an advantage. I was having a conversation with Reid Hoffman the other day, and we were talking about this. You know, I mentioned this long tail of tasks. The humans are better at the one-off tasks, and machines are better at the more common ones. And I said, well, you know, it seems like that machines are kind of marching down that curve. And he said, true, but humans just keep extending the long tail. Humans are great at improvising and coming up with new things. And the example he gave was, suppose that you or I had to beat AlphaZero at a game of Go or chess. Well, on the face of it, we know we would lose. But if we really, really had to beat it, you know, maybe we would. And we probably wouldn't beat it just by playing Go. Like, we would find out where its power supply is, you know? We would find out, you know, how to get some bug introduced into it. You know, humans just have all sorts of creative ways of working, you know, in ways that no coder or no LLM had thought of before. And I do think our species is particularly good at improvising. I was just reading about the spacecraft. I think it was the Voyager spacecraft that's, you know, billions of miles away. It stopped working and they figured some crazy way of reorienting the memory so that they could get the code working again. It was not anything that was ever planned by the original designers, but they found this workaround. Or we've also heard the Apollo 13. You know, Jim Lovell actually came to my house. He was the Apollo 13 pilot. He came to my house when I was like 12 years old. And, you know, they had to improvise all sorts of crazy things. So that may be for a while our comparative advantage is in dealing with the unexpected and dealing with improvisation and being flexible.
Yeah, so actually this reminds me of a story I read that apparently actually human did recently win with AlphaGo, but with some like Go playing AI. Mm-hmm. But the way they did it is they use another AI to find essentially the set of strategies that confuses this engine. So it's like exactly combing something completely out of.
Yeah, yeah. No, they're actually, even if you just use Go strategy, I think there was one where they made this like giant circle that was just like, it was a crazy strategy. And any human would look at it and say, oh my God, you know, they would observe it right away. But AlphaGo had never seen it before, AlphaZero. But, you know, that's a temporary, there's just, it's one example of a general principle that you know, we have years of evolution of figuring out ways to work around whatever puzzle people throw at us.
Okay, so the traditional final question. So, If you think about yourself, Eric, what are you looking forward the most or the least about the future with AI?
As an economist, and maybe this is not me personally, but I really am looking forward to what John Maynard Keynes called the end of the economic problem, that we can finally, first time in history, address, you know, scarcity of food, clothing, shelter. I think we are very close to getting that, and I could see that happening soon. Doesn't mean all our wants and needs. People will always have, you know, ambitions, but basic needs, I think they could be addressed. But for me personally, I would pick two other ones. In the short term, I would love to have a coach and helping me. I'm not as organized, and my system two isn't always in charge. You know, when I think I want to do something, often my system one takes over, and I would love to have a coach kind of remind me to keep, you know, first things first and focus on principles. The other thing I would love is, you know, I love life. I'm having a great time. I'm really enjoying myself, but everyone's getting older. And I've been hanging around with some people here in Silicon Valley, and they have these crazy ideas that AI can help address or reverse aging. I don't know if that's true. I hope it is. I just hope they hurry up because the clock is running.
Okay. Thank you so much, Eric. It was a pleasure to have you here.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, please leave us feedback in the comments and share with your friends.